Folks, we've got two cold opens today. We're gonna do a serious cold open, and then we're gonna do an even more serious cold open.
A
So
colder open, if you will.
colder, it's so frigid, literally so cold. So my first thing I wanted to say is the serious thing, which is, as you know, both of us are involved in organizing, as we all need to be. And it is important when you're organizing to have funds of some course of some sort. Now, the Socialist Shelf podcast is and will remain free for those who are listening. But if you do happen to have some extra money and you appreciate our show, we would love for you to donate it to an organization that we both work with, PSL Atlanta. I'm going to attach a link in the episode description, but it'll be liberationatl.org/donate will be a place you can donate. And if you donate any amount of money, and send me, either through our email or on Twitter or wherever, proof of donation, we will absolutely give you a shout out. But we would really appreciate that because the work that's being done in Atlanta that we're both involved in is vital, especially right now with the struggle for Palestine, struggle against imperialism. And it unfortunately requires some money to keep it going. And it's not like we got a bunch of money behind us. So that's my serious pitch at the opening. So, pause, collect yourself. Now imagine that this is another cold open and then I'm just opening this. So yeah, we'll just between just the only people who will know that this isn't a real cold open are me, the listener, and Joss. So it'll be all good. It'll be a secret between all of us. New
Yes,
cold
just stay with
open.
us. Stay with us.
Joss, I want to read you some lyrics.
Shoot.
We gather here, we line up, weeping in a sunlit room. If I'm on fire, you'll be made of ashes too. Even on the worst day, did I deserve, babe, all the hell you gave me? 'Cause I loved you till my dying day. I didn't have it in myself to go with grace, and you're the hero flying around saving face. If I'm dead to you, why are you at the wake, cursing my name, wishing I stayed? Look at how my tears ricochet. When Taylor Swift wrote this song, she was referring to Obi-Wan Kenobi and Anakin Skywalker. And I want that to just be really important. You have to note that later on, she talks about a ghostly scene, talks about burying someone, but them not actually dying, talks about when I fight, you used to tell me I'm brave, but if when I'm dead to you, why are you at the wake cursing my name? I can go anywhere I want, just not home. Okay. You're talking about, exile there. You can aim for my heart, go for blood, but you would still miss me in my bones. Okay. And I still talk to you. And when you can't sleep at night, you hear my stolen lullabies. It says, so the battleships will sink beneath the waves. You had to kill me, but it killed you just the same. You turned into your worst fears, and you're drunk on your pain and cursing my name. Look at how my tears ricochet. I'm just saying, Taylor Swift, you may have thought you were talking about whatever boyfriend you had at the time, but it is distinctly possible that she had just watched Revenge of the Sith because there's some weird parallels there.
It
I just
does
want.
indeed. It can indeed describe the greatest bromance of all. And, lest we forget, Taylor's other foray into Star Wars lore. Look what you made me do. Not so big a leap to see Anakin in that.
Phenomenal, phenomenal. We will not play the music because we don't want to be sued for more money than we can possibly have, but please enjoy our normal intro music. Can you imagine trying to play?
I'm thinking about it.
Destroyed immediately. Will not risk the Taylor Swift lawsuit.
Thank you.
listening to Socialist Shelf Radio.
So yes, welcome back to the Socialist Shelf. And we are getting back into fiction now that we've dabbled a little bit in philosophy. We've dabbled a little bit, of course, in the self-help genre. We're going to go back to our familiar stomping grounds, fiction. And in particular, a fiction that a lot of us are familiar with. If you've grown up in the United States and you've taken a look outside and seen a movie poster, it is, of course, Star Wars.
Yeah, kind of niche. Kind of a lesser known franchise, you know. But we try and get into the real grit of our culture.
Well, yeah, you know, compared to a cultural a touchstone like a Titan, like Ice Pirates, like, you know, Star Wars is kind of, you know, on the fringe, but you know, it could go somewhere.
Compared to Left Behind or The President Is Missing, it's not much, but you know. Can you imagine if President Is Missing had the like cultural presence of Star Wars somehow? Like the amount of
if that TV show had gotten made, I tell you what, like
it would have been really good. Let me tell you. Jar Jar Binks and The President Is Missing.
Oh man, I mean, and we could go into a deep dive about Jar Jar. I have no doubt that other podcasts with higher production values and nerdier people have done that. But yes, Jar Jar, who notably doesn't appear in this book. We are, of
course, No, that's not true. He does appear in the book.
Really?
You glossed over it. He's in the Senate. He gets mentioned exactly once. Padme is sitting next to him in the Senate when the Emperor ascends to power. He is not important and notably doesn't speak out. And I want to make one more point. Jar Jar, it doesn't make this point, but he's the one who proposes to give the Chancellor emergency powers and Attack of the Clones. Jar Jar, fuck you. This is all your fault.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. When George Lucas says Jar Jar is the key to all this, that's what he's referring to. We are, of course, discussing the novelization of Star Wars Episode 3 by noted fantasy and sci-fi writer Matt Stover.
Mm-hmm. And this book came out, if I'm correct, like a couple months before the film actually drops, which is interesting. In 2006, or I'm sorry, is it 2005?
2005.
In 2005. So, I guess if you really wanted to get spoiled on the film, you could read this book and then be, you know, moderately disappointed by some of the differences where the book kind of is superior in every way. But it is interesting because this book also is written pre the Disney acquisition of Star Wars. So we'll get into it. But this is still the era of legends. This is where there is so much Star Wars paraphernalia, content, books, comics, video games, and they're just all kind of canonized in this very weird pre-2014, pre-Disney sort of resetting the canon, sort of strange world. And this book very much exists in that and is constantly referencing it and pulling from that. But Joss, you want to talk about Matthew Stover himself?
Yeah, absolutely. He's still writing, albeit less frequently, of course. He was born in 1962 on January 29th. He went to Danville High School in Danville, Illinois, class of 1979. He went to Drake University in Des Moines, and he lived in Chicago for a while, moved to St. Petersburg. His first books came out in 97. He is first and foremost a fantasy writer. He's written the historical fiction Bara the Pict and the fantasy series The Acts of Cain, which starts with Heroes Die. He considers himself a writer in the sort of, we discussed the new wave of science fiction, of course, in our Kim Stanley Robinson Ministry for the Future episode, right? The point at the sci-fi genre where it leaves behind, you know, ray guns and robots and your Flash Gordon, and gets into the more introspective, the more culturally, socially conscious, darker sorts of stories that would eventually give way to like cyberpunk and that sort of thing. So new wave, he has great respect for. He considers himself part of the next wave, as he calls it, of fantasy, you know?
I was going to say, he's definitely not new wave.
No, yeah, certainly not, you know? Again, he has great respect for those who came before him, but he's doing something similar to his mind in fantasy, right? Interrogating the various themes that one is used to, you know, such as the violence as a spectacle, right? Not in just society, but in the everyday life of a martial society. He does that in the Kane series, right? He also writes in the Star Wars universe. He's the author of 4 books in that universe and a couple of short stories. Traitor, which is a New Jedi Order novel, and that series we'll touch on. There's a lot to it. Shatterpoint, which is a novel of the Clone Wars from Mace Windu's perspective, the Jedi Master.
Kind of important to this book, actually.
Oh, referenced several times, yes. Luke Skywalker and the Shadows of Mindor.
Yes! I know this book. I know this book. Sorry.
Yes.
He wrote Shadows of Mindor.
He did.
Holy shit. I'm sorry. I'm realizing this on the pod. I'm very excited. Sorry, I cut you off, Josh.
No, Jacob, unpack this because I didn't expect the delight writ across your face. Like, I want to know more about this.
Luke Skywalker and the Shadows of Mindor is one of the most insane books I have ever read. I read it, I think I must have been a freshman in high school. It must have been like, I don't know, that age around there. Because that's when I was like most into like Star Wars, like novels, like probably from 7th grade to like 9th grade, like that kind of era for a few years. Because I was like really into the legends and all that. Mm-hmm. You know, always liked the movies, big fan. I say big fan. I guess that maybe not. I wouldn't be considered a big fan anymore because I definitely haven't seen all the Disney properties. But I definitely was like really into it back in the day. But Shadows of Mindor, I specifically remember reading the entire book on an OG Kindle. I read it. It was mostly because I kept having to go to my little brother's. They were in a like a little league baseball team. Mm-hmm. And I kept having to go with them to just like kind of watch their practices. And I would be incredibly bored and waiting for my parents to pick me up. And I read the entirety of this book across a few such practices. And the book is basically the story of Luke Skywalker shortly after the events of Episode 6. So he's like full Jedi Knight and he's full Jedi Knight. And like, they're just like kind of wiping up the last remnants of the Empire. And Luke encounters a dark side nihilist, a guy who's been trapped on this one planet. And the Emperor was like afraid of him basically on the planet of Mindor. And the Emperor was like, yeah, I'm leaving that guy there. And this guy comes from an order who basically is like, if you worship the dark side, you should want all things to die. Like, he believes the absolute obliteration of life should be the like mission of the dark side. So he's like, the Sith are fake dark side users. They use it just for like power. He's like, it shouldn't be for power. They don't actually believe in the dark side. He's like,
bunch of fucking phonies.
Yeah. You know, like the way that in this book, the Jedi are like dogmatists about the light. This guy is like a dogmatist about the dark. Whereas the Sith are more just like, yeah, the dark is useful. It's a tool. This guy is like a dogmatist. Luke has to like confront him directly. And it's where like after this book, Luke gets promoted to general. In the New Republic army, and Luke immediately, abandons the Republic. He leaves it behind and says, I can't anymore. Like, war itself disgusts me, because Luke, in order to defeat this guy, has to kill everyone on a planet. Mm-hmm. Basically this guy has doing this like dark spell. I don't remember the specifics, but Luke reaches in this dude's brain, feels all these people's minds, and just like collectively kills all of them. Like, Luke does a mass slaughter. It also has one of my favorite just single Jedi moments I remember, which is a bunch of troopers shoot at Luke. He steps forward, puts forward his hand, and moves it fast enough to individually intercept each laser with his hand, is completely unharmed. And then he says, you got me, and puts his hands out and allows himself to be arrested. Basically in a show of like, I'm absolutely in control here, but like, take me to
Yeah. You know, it's Superman and fucking, however you feel about this movie, it's Superman and Man of Steel just casually breaking the handcuffs, right? You know,
right. It's like that, but it's like right before he surrenders doing that. It's very funny. Anyway, it's unhinged. It's weird. And it makes perfect sense that Matthew Stover wrote it.
And what you're telling me is that there is indeed precedent for Luke's withdrawal from the Republic, as shown in, say, the new trilogy, right?
Yes.
But in Shadows of Mindor, of course, there's much more of a material basis for it. You know?
Yes, that's correct. And then people in
it's not like, just that he was mean to a kid.
Right. And to speak on that a little more, like, legends, when I say legends, I mean Star Wars content outside the original 6 films at all prior to the Disney acquisition. The first Legends content was made between Episode 4, the original, New Hope, and Empire Strikes Back. It's called Splinter of a Mind's Eye, written by Alan Dean Foster, published in, I think, 1978. And it's basically a story of like Luke on this like planet finding a crystal that gives him the power to duel Darth Vader. It's super neat. I've read it, and I actually have a George Lucas quote about it, and it's interesting. Quote, and he said this in 1996 in the re-release of Splinter of the Mind's Eye. Quote, after Star Wars was released, it became apparent that my story, however many films it took to tell, was only one of thousands that could be told about the characters who inhabit its galaxy. But these were not stories that I was destined to tell. Instead, they would spring from the imagination of other writers, inspired by the glimpse of a galaxy that Star Wars provided. Today, it is an amazing, if unexpected, legacy of Star Wars that so many gifted writers are contributing new stories to the saga. End quote. And that is what like Legends was. There was only a very few rules. You were supposed to not too directly violate other things that happened. You weren't supposed to, there were plot holes, but you were supposed to do the best you could to not whatever. And that meant writers, the later they went, the more they had to study, like not just like books, but like games, comics, obscure, like random stuff. Cause it was all canon. And it was just this absurd cacophony of just stuff that, like, a lot of which was really good. Some of it was absolutely dog shit, terrible. And it just is everything in between.
I remember,
I really loved it.
I remember my father telling me a little bit about, because his frame of reference, of course, he was a much bigger, like, Star Trek book guy than Star Wars, right? And Star Trek, of course, the literary canon of that was much more tightly controlled, like you had to pass a lore test and that sort of thing. He mentioned
nothing like that in this.
Yeah, I mean, and like he mentioned in particular the sheer power levels that literary Star Wars dealt with, especially into the New Republic era. Like I remember him telling me that Luke and was it Luke and Mara Jade's kids, or was it Leia and Han's kids? That was
okay. So they both have kids that get really powerful.
I remember him telling me that at least one of them was so powerful they could lift a starship like fully intact out of a sun.
That's actually like, okay, so I think that happens a couple times.
Really?
I can think of two separate occasions on which that happens, which is pretty funny. So Luke gets the power to go to the realm of the dead and back, and like just when he dies, just decides to be dead.
Yeah.
He can control black holes.
Yes, Palpatine can do like planet-sized force storms as well. Oh yeah, Palpatine comes back in the books, by the way. He gets cloned several times.
Somehow Palpatine returned.
So yes, exactly. And they go into detail about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as one should do when they're doing something that, you know, seismic. Imagine that. Anyway,
go for it.
So yes, Matt Stover. Matt Stover plays in this world, has played in this world to great effect. This is neither here nor there, but this also caught my eye. He's done a Magic the Gathering novel. He also worked on the novelization of God of War with Robert Vardaman.
Interesting. So yeah, he's kind of versed in this novelization world.
He is, yes. Mm-hmm. And he draws on a couple of really interesting influences here. He, of course, is a martial artist, an avid martial artist. He studied...
Yeah,
he studies this form of unarmed combat. The name escapes me right now. But it's descended from Bruce Lee's Jeet Kune Do. Which, of course, you know, Lee died before he could really formalize it. So a lot of people have kind of branched off it in their own ways. But yeah, you can tell with his attention to the physicality of the combat, you know, of grips and stances and footwork.
He's very interested in it. Yes. Yeah,
and the other big influence on his writing shows itself in his character work. You know, he talks in several interviews about his theater background, right? A quote from an interview from 06. A large part of effective character creation on stage is training yourself to see the world the way the character sees it. If you can do that, all the characters' choices, no matter how bizarre or perverse they may seem from the outside, develop their own internal logic, because they arise from the way the character expects others or the world in general to react. That's what makes these choices convincing and goes a long way toward helping the audience believe the character is a living, breathing human being. I mean, Jacob, you know, you and I were both theater kids to various extents, right? You know, when you're acting, right, you deliver your lines and you execute your blocking from the perspective of the character in question because you speak and act from your perspective, IRL, you know?
Right.
And he is adept at, I mentioned this to you the other day, he's adept at... at channeling those various perspectives, which is what you have to do, the bare minimum, when you are writing a novel from several perspectives. You have to be able to do that, A, and he's also very good at calibrating the prose accordingly. B, you know, you'll get asides, you will get, you know, different turns of phrase, vocabulary from the prose passages of this novel, depending on whose perspective they are rendered from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is like such a big story, you know, Revenge of the Sith. And of course, he does not, unlike something like Shatterpoint or Shadows of Mendor, or I forget the last one, he did not conceive of this story. This is George Lucas's story that he helped write the screenplay of. But this is a novelization. So prior to the movie's release, Stover basically is allowed to read this screenplay, wrote the book, and then George Lucas apparently did line edits on this book, which is very interesting to me. Which, like, I remember reading Stover talking about that, and he said people were asking if it was like canon breaking or if it's still canon or whatever. And he says, well, George Lucas did line edits and said it was good to go. So I think my book is still canon. And I do appreciate that defense, but, yeah, sorry, not to cut you off. Go. What else is going on with Stover?
Well, he is not, he has also said, he says something that I respect a lot, which is, you know, identity is not an object, it's a process, right? You know, mm-hmm. You're constantly shaping yourself, you are constantly reworking yourself according to the influences around you and the situations that you're in. You know, it's a very dialectical point of view, A. He's also said there is no moral ambiguity in my work, right? You know, he doesn't really do, he's not really interested in absolute good versus absolute evil, right? But he, you know, neither is he interested in, neither is he interested in shying away from, you know, characters' brushes with morality, you know, and escapes from morality. You know, if a character does something in this world that is, you know, that has moral consequences for them, you know, he's not going to shy away from it, you know, right. But again, it's a choice that they make because it makes sense to them in the moment. It's infinitely more compelling than, you know, the simple motivation of I am good, I am evil, you know, I am doing something because of this, my place in this grand narrative, right? Actually, there is a part toward the end of the book where he directly counterposes such things, right? There, it's the Yoda versus Palpatine duel juxtaposed with Anakin and Obi-Wan, right? And he says, yeah, you know, this is dark side versus light side, good versus evil, winner take all when it's Yoda and Palpatine. And it's nothing to write home about is that duel. The more emotionally compelling duel is between Anakin and Obi-Wan, right? Where he explicitly says, look, this isn't good versus evil. This isn't Jedi versus Sith. This is Anakin versus Obi-Wan. This is two people who, you know, to some degree still love each other and they're fighting.
Yeah.
Yeah. His character work is why I've, you know, this is my third or fourth time reading this book now. It's why I keep coming back to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To speak to my experience with the book, I read it. It was literally, so my father is a football coach and one of the assistant coaches on the team was reading it. And I was like a little kid. And I was like, what is that? And he was like, it's the Revenge of the Sith novel. And he just like, gave it to me. I don't know if he was bored with it or if he had finished it and was thumbing through it, but I read it when I was like, I guess in like sixth grade or whatever. So this may have been my gateway drug into like Star Wars Legends, to be honest.
Oh, hell yeah.
I'm not certain of that, but I want to say, yeah, shout out to Coach Dennis.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's your gateway drug. You know, I'm effectively still lingering at that gateway, right? Because I've read this. I've read in sixth grade. It was that one book that I mentioned on the pod before, I know, where, you know, the kid on Tatooine teams up with Boba Fett to fight Dr. Evazan's zombie.
Yeah, I think that's right? one of the Tales from Jabba's Palace books, probably.
Yeah, it's again, you know, zombie apocalypse in Star Wars. Star Wars in its own way is like the Simpsons of the sci-fi or space opera realm, right? Everything has been done at one point or another, which, you know, for good and for ill, for very good.
It's certainly there are whole podcasts that get into the merits of what is good and bad in Star Wars. I certainly am not going to be the one to like venture in. I certainly, my takes on Star Wars are not particularly hot or interesting. I'm like, just cards on the table. like the original three movies the best. Saw the prequels as a kid. I know they're objectively not great movies, but I have like good relationship to them. And the new Disney movies, some of them are better than others. I don't know. I don't have, and I don't care that much about the TV shows. That's basically like my relationship to it. My period of most obsessed with Star Wars was that like sixth to ninth grade of like reading the novels, being into really like Jedi Academy, New Jedi Order, Old Republic, a lot of that stuff. I played some of the video games. I really liked Force Unleashed. I liked the Old Republic Online video game. Yeah, one of these days I'm going to play Jedi Survivor. That game looks fun. I don't know. but yeah, I was like hella into these legends for a minute. But Stover, I think, but that I also was going to ask, I don't know if you know this, Joss. I guess he probably hadn't seen the movie when he wrote this, because there's no. Because like he maybe got to see clips as he did the process. He had the screenplay. I mean, the book releases shortly before the movie comes out. So maybe he even gets to see some of it. But like he definitely hadn't seen the film in its completion. So which leads to some key differences between the book and the movie. For example, General Grievous doesn't breathe in the book. In the movie, he coughs incessantly, and it's kind of annoying. So things like that. It's some weird differences.
It really strikes me as, I don't know, like it's a bit of direction where you're like, oh yeah, you know, you're this character, like give him a thing, you know, give him a mannerism, right? And it's not really, you know, it's not really, I mean, not to say that everything has to quote unquote move the plot forward, right? But it's just something that kind of sticks out, right?
But yeah, what else? So what has Stover done since this? What, anything else notable about Stover?
Yeah, I mean, he's slowed down a little bit, right? You know, Acts of Cain, right? And of course, there's a period of illness that explains at least the gap between the first and the second book, right? So they come out in 1997, 01, 08, and then 12, right? You know, Star Wars, of course, his work is written from 2002 to 2008 in that space. The God of War and the Magic novels follow in 2010. He does have a short story from 2021. More recently, but I don't see, and I'm looking at a couple of lists of his here. He's active on Twitter, of course. But again, he's and you know, by his own admission, he's slowed down since about 2012, 2015.
Gotcha. Anything interesting that you maybe found politically or ideologically on him? Browsing his Twitter account, he seems like a pretty traditional liberal to me.
Yeah.
Shit about third party candidates, some of that.
You know, of course there are things we do agree on too. Of course, he celebrated the death of our own IRL Sith Lord this week, Henry Kissinger.
Oh, did he? Awesome.
I think he posted one of those like, is Kissinger even in these thing, in this thing memes.
Oh, good.
I don't know if he did anything day of, but yeah,
that's fine.
You know,
yeah.
So, you know, we certainly have some of the same enemies. We don't have some of the same opinions about, you know, politically what is to be done. But what I do find interesting about Stover in this book here is how he deals with blind faith in institutions, right? Mm-hmm. And how he deals with the necessity sometimes of fighting for them, and how he deals with the cost of hewing to one or another dogma without critically examining it or allowing it to evolve.
Absolutely.
You know, which burns the Jedi, which burns the Sith, which burns
Anakin.
Literally, yes, exactly. Unless you're playing the Revenge of the Sith video game where he kills Obi-Wan and he mercs Sidious like he planned.
As he should. Well, let's get into the novel itself. So again, this is a novelization of Revenge of the Sith. I can say just like from the beginning, my opinion generally on Revenge of the Sith as a film is there's a lot of interesting concepts running around, and George Lucas doesn't seem particularly interested in characters a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. He's famously just not great with actors, not like in a mean way, just in that he's like kind of uninterested in performances. And I think he was just kind of trying to shove a lot in there, and like there's some cool stuff, and there's some stuff that sticks with me, and there's the stuff that doesn't. But Star Wars being such a big universe with so many cool concepts and ideas, it like lends itself to imagination. It lends itself to seeing something in the background and being like, oh, what's that? And then it's, you know, there's a whole industry now of explaining what that is, you know, notably maybe the most famous version being like Boba Fett showing up in Empire Strikes Back as just like a kind of minor character because he looks so cool that he gets basically propelled to extreme fame and prominence.
The illogical sort of conclusion of that is like, doesn't the fucking dude who sells Obi-Wan death sticks like get his own book?
Yeah, it's to a point of just hyper saturation, no doubt.
But nevertheless, we do here touch on something that's very, very important, not only in the expansion of the universe, but in what it says about Matt Stover as a writer, because he himself says, you know, he's not really interested. I mean, we talked about his martial background, of course, but he's not really interested by his own admission in grand strategy, right? He's not really interested in big sweeping battles. Now, of course, we open in the intro, right? The skies of Coruscant blaze with war, right? It opens as the movie does with the Battle of Coruscant, right? With the Confederacy of Independent Systems lightning raid on the capital planet. But he quickly zooms in to whenever he's writing a battle, he says, you know, he tries to distill it down to the perspective of like the people navigating it, right? And the chaos, you know, around it, right? He renders it the action kind of nebulously to replicate the chaos in a pretty, honest sort of way. Authentic is the word I'm looking for. And in particular, what he says about the reaction of the people of Coruscant to the battle, I think, sets the vibe in a way that the movie doesn't really do. Right here on the second page. Across the remnants of the Republic, stunned beings watch in horror as the battle unfolds live on the HoloNet. Everyone knows the war has been going badly. Everyone knows that more Jedi are killed or captured every day. But the Grand Army of the Republic has been pushed out of system after system. But this? A strike at the very heart of the Republic? An invasion of Coruscant itself? How can this happen? It's a nightmare, and no one can wake up. So, to my mind, of course, it's 2005. I think there's something distinctly 9/11 about this. I think there's a certain anxiety that, oh, you know, we're insulated from this, you know, without getting into the whole geopolitical, landscape of this, right? There is a sense of, oh my God, you know, this is coming home. This is something that happens over there. It doesn't happen over here. There is that sense in the American consciousness, I think, that this taps into. But what this leads into that interests me more is this is all the adults thinking that way, as Stover points out. He says that all the younglings in their various, you know, forms, you know, human and otherwise, are confident, endlessly confident, that the day will be saved. And who will the day be saved by? Kenobi and Skywalker, Skywalker and Kenobi, Anakin and Obi-Wan, Obi-Wan and Anakin. You know, the two most famous Jedi in the galaxy. They have this role, this titanic stature in the minds of kids who believe in, you know, good and evil, and these guys are good, right? And that is something that we don't get in the film, right? We get Obi-Wan and Anakin talking about, oh yeah, you know, you saved me back on, you know, this or that planet, but unless you've engaged with the Clone Wars and the other peripheral TV shows and whatnot, you don't see that in the film. It's just something that you have to, that is left up to the imagination.
Interestingly enough, yeah, you even have this quick moment where the adults are like, what if the Jedi turn dark? And you note that like they're worried about the Jedi and that they can just go dark, that they can just snap. And it is revealed later that there's like a separatist shadow network that feeds things about the Jedi. And I mean, this is obviously all part of Palpatine's eventual plan to turn the public, but I like how this chapter kind of ends. And it's, you know, talking about how the young kids are like, no, it'll be fine. And then it says, the adults know that legendary heroes are merely legends and not heroes at all. These adults can take no comfort from their younglings. Palpatine is captured. Grievous will escape. The Republic will fall. No mere human beings can turn this tide. No mere human beings would even try. Not even Kenobi and Skywalker. And so it is that these adults across the galaxy watch the HoloNet with ashes where their hearts should be. Ashes because they can't see two prismatic bursts of real space reversion far out beyond the planet's gravity well, because they can't see a pair of starfighters crisply jettison hyperdrive rings and streak into the storm of separatist vulture fighters with all guns blazing. A pair of starfighters, Jedi starfighters, only two. Two is enough. Two is enough because the adults are wrong and their younglings are right. Though this is the end of the Age of Heroes, it has saved its best for last. And it has this kind of gravitas, this drama. And it also, I wanted to read that also because it shows how Stover writes. It's kind of got this choppiness. He likes to note the technology and use the terminology from the world without over-explaining it. Mm-hmm. Like, he likes to say prismatic bursts of real space reversion. He doesn't sit you down and talk through how the real space reversion works and whatever. He's just like, yeah, it's a Jedi starfighter. Figure it out, man. But yeah, he wants to use the terms. And I think part of it is just because that's like a good way of writing and it's interesting and lets you imagine. I think the other part is because he realizes this is a novelization. And there's something to that as well. Like, you've seen this. Probably.
You know, and again, you know, he's consistent in this language, right? You know, real space versus hyperspace. Like, as you go through, as you get immersed in this, eventually it'll click in your mind without even really actively thinking about it. Okay, hyperspace versus real space. All right, this is one thing. This is, you know, coming out of it. You know, what's the word that I'm looking for? Right. It's immersion, I guess. I already said that, but you get, you see what I'm saying.
And the book does explain who the characters are and what's going on somewhat, but it does also kind of assume you have a little bit of like, you know what a Jedi is, you know, like, you know, it'll say who Anakin and Obi-Wan are, but really it's describing who Anakin and Obi-Wan are in this moment. It doesn't say Anakin, the boy born on Tatooine, and do the whole backstory. What it is it talks about how Anakin is feeling now, how Obi-Wan is feeling now. Mm-hmm. And that is something that, you know, like Joss mentioned, the Clone Wars would come along some years later after this, the TV show, and really flesh this out. The Clone Wars being really a thing that takes this Clone War era and puts to film in a way that's kind of enjoyable, makes Anakin and Obi-Wan more lived-in characters, makes this whole era kind of pop. Now, the Clone Wars TV show and Stover's novel, you know, directly violate each other on several points just because that's just kind of how it goes. They contradict each other dramatically, but that's how it goes with these, something at this scale. But yeah, it is interesting to me though, that he chooses to kind of construct it in this way. And also but that is also kind of an example of how it talks. And then it leads into part one, and it has kind of, I don't know if a poem is the right word, but it has this like running thing through it. This like running essay on the dark, like the dark is generous. Its gift is concealment. And it's got this whole thing that goes throughout the novel at the beginning of each part.
This gave me eyeliner just to read.
Oh yeah. No doubt. No doubt. It's like the comforting illusion, the ease of gentle dreams and night's embrace. And of course it'll go through the whole thing and talk about the darkness and how even the stars wink out. But then at the end it says, but love is the candle that reignites the stars is kind of
And you know,
the new hope as it is.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it waits to the very end of the book for that moment of hope, because again, the adults ultimately are right. It must be noted, you know, the Republic at the end does fall. You know, Grievous does escape, at least in the moment here. Palpatine, you know, does start the book captured, and you know, he becomes the you know, the tyrant we all know as the Emperor, right? Mm-hmm. But that's the thing, right? Stover allows us to exist in this moment and lets us experience the hope right along with the kids, because you know what? There is a victory of the light, you know, even though, you know, with each victory of the light, it is the dark that wins.
There is also this notable thing with Stover that when you're reading this book, you can kind of feel the possibility of this going different ways, right? There is like a conflict to this that when you're watching the film, it's like, okay, this is just kind of what happens. Mm-hmm. It all feels kind of preset. You talked about a play. It feels like everyone's kind of reading their lines. There is something in this book where everything feels lived in and vital, and like there's so many possibilities that could arise at any moment that it like makes you wonder, like, well, if they'd switch their tactics here, or oh, if this, you know, if a random gunshot here, you know, there is a little bit more of a, which is what I think a lot of the fun of like the Legends novels and all that stuff is it gives you kind of that room to speculate and think and dream a little bit. Cause mm-hmm. I spent this whole book being like, if the Jedi would just do this, then everything would be fine. And it like pissed me off. But not in the way that the book is bad, but in like it like leads itself to make you think that way. Whereas in the film, it's kind of like, yeah, this is all just kind of a thing. It feels like everyone's just kind of playing their part.
It is certainly the fundamental, it is the tyranny of the prequel, right? Because you mm-hmm. know where this is leading, right? And the question is, okay, well, you know, what leads what, how can you make this compelling when you know what the end is going to be, right? And that's, and again, it's the perspective, I think, that is the only answer to that, right? You have to have the benefit of seeing this from somebody who doesn't know the score.
Yes. And then you have the introduction of Anakin and Obi-Wan, these two friends. And you know, if you're listening to this, you know Star Wars, you know the deal. But it introduces, you know, Anakin, Obi-Wan is the perfect Jedi, basically, and Anakin as the problematic but incredibly powerful Jedi. And notably, it introduces
you're a loose cannon, Skywalker.
Basically, yeah. And it introduces the idea of the Star Dragon, the dead Star Dragon, which is a concept unique to the book, which is Anakin remembering as a kid finding out that stars die out. And he used to have this sort of superstition that all fire had dragons inside of it, including stars. And so there was a dead Star Dragon. All things die. He cannot stop death. He cannot stop the collapse and end of life. And so the dead Star Dragon represents his fear, the thing whispering to him. And notably, and this was not made for this book, but this is a thing from Legends, Anakin is referred to as the hero with no fear by the public. That's his, like, and that comes from, I forget the book, but where he like crash lands and comes out of the woods fighting alongside a tribe, and they've literally painted him up in their war paint. It's like from an early post episode 2, pre episode 3 novel, I forget which one, and like they literally call him the hero with no fear. And of course it's like, it's irony because he is incredibly afraid, which is not allowed for a Jedi, as is a lot of things are not allowed for a Jedi. You're kind of not allowed to, because like the Jedi have to be stoic. They have to be good monks, but warrior monks, but also, I don't know. A big thesis of this book is also that the Jedi are just kind of deeply hypocritical, set in their ways, and were setting themselves up for a fall.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, there is, again, you do get the perspective of the Jedi Council on this, right? You know, they discuss it when they're talking about the will of the Force and how that really means that I know very little, right? When we talk about the will of the Force, we're like, okay, so we don't know what the future has in store. We don't know what actually the Force wills, but we are comfortable following the flow of things where they may lead, right? And I mean, Obi-Wan sums it up right here in chapter one, you know, until the possible becomes actual, it is only a distraction. Be mindful of what is, not what might be, which, you know, good for getting through your everyday life, you know, rolling your Sisyphus rock up your Sisyphus hill, but it's a very preservatory ideology to my mind. It's not really a prescription for a future. It's certainly not a political project, you know, and the Jedi, to their credit, are not intended to be a political body.
Mm-hmm. A big part of the like flaw of the Jedi is that they, as this institution, this religious institution, these guardians get pulled closer and closer through the year into the structure of this dying democracy, the Republic, that's getting ever more corrupt and ever more bloated and ever more terrible. The Republic, which doesn't even have an army, a formal standing army, until Attack of the Clones, and then the Jedi are turned into soldiers, which makes them inherently like the contradictions hyper inherent. The Jedi are forced to, you know, deal with what they can't possibly deal with. And then, you know, Clone Wars is a lot about that. The Clone Wars, I mean, it gets a lot of praise. I would say early seasons are a lot, there's a lot of filler in there, but there's some really interesting stuff. There's some jokes that like the first four seasons of Clone Wars are like, whippy, we're going to kill some droids. And the last three seasons of Clone Wars are a guy on the ground, like, holy shit, that was a child. Like I just murdered a child. That is a little bit how it feels.
Oh, yeah.
They become war, you know, the classic meme of Yoda saying, war criminal I shall become, you know, like that's kind of what's going on here. Cause the galaxy is in the middle of a civil war.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, bad our intel was, only children those were, you know?
Yeah, like, exactly.
Like, that sort of thing. You know, that's what Shatterpoint is about, you know? Like, it's one of the lost 20, right? One of the 20 who strayed from the Jedi Order and became Sith, or, you know, embraced the dark side, right? Depa Balaba, that's what Shatterpoint is about, right? Because she was an apprentice of Mace Windu. She went all the way to Jedi Master. She went to, I believe it's Harun Kal that the book is set on. And, you know, drawing heavily from Heart of Darkness, is, you know, corrupted and broken by the you know, horrors of war.
Speaking of the war, it's the Confederacy of Independent Systems, the CIS. I've seen people joke online that when they learned the term cis or cisgender, for a while they thought it was talking about the Confederacy of Independent Systems. They're like, I thought everybody just... I saw there's a classic Tumblr post where someone says, when everyone was complaining about cis people, I thought they just really hated droids. Like, I don't...
Roger,
on
Roger.
The trans Tumblr, yeah. They are led by Count Dooku, this fallen Jedi. And you get a perspective in this book that is just that I see show up nowhere in any other Legends novel, which is that Dooku is a human supremacist that wants to like usher in an empire of man. He literally yes. uses the term empire of man from what is that? That's in Warhammer, right?
40K. Empire.
Yeah. But he has this concept that, and he's being absolutely suckered because, of course, treachery is the way of the Sith. But the CIS is interesting because their criticism of the Republic is objectively correct, that the Republic is this corrupt, horrible bureaucracy that is falling apart. And I don't know if you want to get Marxist about it, like a late capitalist state that's like trending back towards fascism. But then the CIS is basically like a bourgeois rebellion. It's like the Trade Federation and the techno union.
Yeah, the Trade Federation, Techno Union, Intergalactic Banking Clan, Corporate Alliance, the Commerce Guild, you know, it's all the fucking, it's all the fucking CEOs. It's this specific part of the, of their billionaire, I guess like quadrillionaire class in the galaxy, right?
And we don't have to get into, there's some, not in this book, but in the movies, some problematic depictions of the aliens that represent the the bankers.
But, but yeah, you know, their perspective is, you know, they want to drain the swamp, you know?
Yeah.
They happen to also be swamp things.
Yeah. Yeah. The book doesn't, I don't think, falls into any bad stereotypes. It's also just working with what the movie gave. Mm-hmm. Mostly I'm talking about like the voice acting choices. Holy shit.
Oh yeah.
But yeah. And in this book, it says Dooku actually specifically chose aliens to lead the Confederacy so that it would make it easier for the new empire to be human centric, which is, which is like a weird thing to introduce and not do anything with, which of course you can't because Dooku dies, but it's just like another thing Stover's like throwing into this world. Cause he's just like, yeah, Dooku perspective. We're never going to get this again. Dooku thinks this, and this. He's a gentleman. He has this idea of the dark side. And that's also an interesting way he depicts the Force, because the Force is feels very generic in a lot of these movies. There are some interesting visual depictions here and there. I think like, you know, Dagobah is probably like the height of that in any of the films. Or maybe Rey and like the examining that like crystal cave or whatever.
You won't believe your eyes when the X-Wing rise. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But this book is like, everyone has this different perception of the Force. Like they see the Force differently, which makes sense because they're an individual being interacting with this cosmic. So like Dooku has this like very much like, I am the center of the universe. The dark side makes me the center. Anakin is like this whirlwind. He is just power and it's everything and it's conflict. Obi-Wan has like made peace with everything. Like he literally just feels everything around him.
Yeah, Windu, it's literally described as a flow, yeah.
Yeah, Windu sees the forces of historical materialism and still fumbles.
Literally.
This book. Fucking Windu. Holy shit. Absolute massive
more like,
L's.
More like lose do.
So true. So true. More like lose. Yeah. Lose do that. That I was gonna say lose don't, but he does. So yeah. And you know, plot wise, they kill Dooku. It's Anakin's like first brutal murder. And you have this, you know, he thinks he's going on to kill Grievous. And I wanted to quote again, because there is a lot of moments in this book where it says, this is how it feels to be Anakin Skywalker for now. And this is, I think, one of the first of them. It says, this is how it feels to be Anakin Skywalker for now. The Supreme Chancellor returns your look with a hint of smile and a sliver of an improving nod. And for you, this tiny, trivial, comradely victory sparks a warmth and ease that relaxes the dragon grip of dread on your heart. Forget that you are captured. You and Obi-Wan have been captured before. Forget the deteriorating ship. But forget the Jedi-killing droids. You've faced worse. Forget General Grievous. What is he compared to Dooku? He can't even use the Force. So now here you are. The situation comes down to this. You're walking between the two best friends you've ever had, with your precious droid friend faithfully worrying after your heels, on your way to win the Clone Wars. And it goes on for a little bit, and it says, this is how it feels to be Anakin Skywalker for now. And later, towards the end of the book, when he finally becomes Vader, it says, this is how it feels to be Anakin Skywalker forever. And that's it, it's kind of like a running theme through the book, one of his very dramatic overtures that he pulls, for lack of a better term.
And again, you know, it's a really, really like cursory reading of it, right, would be like, oh, what are you doing? Like, you're telling and you're not showing. But again, like, you're immersing yourself in this perspective, right, so that you can be right there with the character when inevitably they have this worldview laid out, and then it's immediately struck down, right? You know, yeah. And it really is something that has to be experienced, I think. It's quite charming.
And there is a level of cheese, of course. Star Wars is cheesy. Like, yeah. It has lines. Like, I love it. It switches out real world sayings for like Star Wars sayings, like wild bantha chase, or whenever the force closes a hatch, it opens a viewport, things like that.
Do you think, because you mentioned that this was line edited by George Lucas.
That's Lucas right there.
I was about to say, like, there are all these similes. There are all these metaphors, like, colder than the frost on a Minox's mouth, right? Swifter than the tongue of a Garolian ghost viper.
Stover said specifically that's the kind of thing Lucas added to the book.
I fucking knew it.
That guy Lucas is hilarious, dude.
Lucas has a gift for I mean, you remember, like, fucking, you remember the planet that Obi-Wan is from? You remember it?
No.
So he came up with it on an episode of Jon Stewart. Like, it came up in conversation, like, Jon Stewart, oh yeah, you know, where is Obi-Wan Kenobi from? And Lucas was like, Stewjon?
Stewjon.
And that was it. That was it. That was the canon from then on.
That's how it goes. I did read a book once about Obi-Wan as a Jedi, Jedi apprentice. And Obi-Wan falls in love and has a relationship with another young Jedi Padawan named Ciri Tosh. And then Qui-Gon and Yoda say, yo, we know what you were doing with Ciri. And then Obi-Wan's like, oh, my bad. And he rejects her. And then it's like later
Ciri,
on.
Ciri, yeah. End our relationship.
Yeah, literally. And then she'll like proceed to die later on between episodes 1 and 2. And so then, like, oh, and then it's kind of like a flash forward. And it's like when Anakin says, see, I don't understand. I do, because I made out with a girl when I was 15 one time. And then Yoda yelled at me about it.
But again, you know, you have that depth of lore that Stover is drawing on, yes. Right? You know, and not just from his own, you know, previous Shatterpoint. You know, there's stuff in here shot through the whole expanded universe.
I also like some little lore additions he makes himself. There's a fun one where, did you catch who Grievous is fighting against at the ship battle?
Lord Nita.
Lord Nita, who Vader will choke out in episode 5. Will choke
no
to death.
Way.
Yeah, he's Admiral Nita, who fails to catch Han Solo, and he says, apologies accepted, Admiral.
Well, that's the thing. Is Lorth Nita the guy who says, like, oh, you know, like your hokey space religion?
No, that's a different guy. No, that's, I'm talking about episode 5 where he says, I'll apologize to him personally because I lost Han Solo. When Han's on, like, the Millennium Falcon's, like, on the side of the Star Destroyer.
Got it.
And then he says, apologies accepted. And his body gets dragged off because he's choked him to death.
Damn. Yeah. Damn.
That's how Anita dies, with thunderous applause from the audience, because that's a cool scene.
Well, and indeed, I mean, you know, I could have answered my own question there as well, because I just remembered, you know, there's a bit when the flagship, the Invisible Hand, is crashing to the surface of the planet, and Lorth Nita's like, yeah, you know, I've heard of the Force in passing, I haven't really believed in it, but, you know, I'll mutter a silent prayer to it this time. By the way, I love it. I didn't really pick up on this until this third read-through, but the Invisible Hand is not, like, specifically Grievous's flagship. It is a Trade Federation flagship that he has commandeered, essentially.
Yeah.
And I fucking love that it's called the Invisible Hand, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you might as well call it...
so funny.
Like, there's another ship called, you know, the Labor Theory of Value or whatever. Like,
that'd be wielded by Bail Organa's Marxist rebels.
Oh, 100%. Bail Organa's the Alderaan Communist Party.
Yeah, no, Bail Organa is not a Marxist. He's a bourgeois national liberation fighter. The Marxists are led by Saw Gerrera, who is a real character in Star Wars, played by Forrest Whitaker, right? In Rogue One.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not mistaken.
Quite effectively.
He's also in Clone Wars. Very in there. Like, he's too extreme. RIP to that guy. But yeah, I also, my last note about this whole like first act where they save Palpatine from the spaceship is just, bro, imagine if the ship blew up on reentry. Because like that one, Palpatine was doing a big gamble with that one. Because like, imagine the ship blows up and it's just like, well, what happens next?
Oh, yeah.
I don't even know what his plan was there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Sidious engineers a very... I mean, he engineers his own capture, right? He engineers, you know, him being in the middle of all this space battle, you know, this droid invasion of Coruscant. But I mean, you know, he is Darth Sidious, right? Multiple times throughout the book, he's described as like a physical, like living darkness, right? One assumes that, you know, by putting himself at the center of this, he can also just like subtly turn things aside. I mean, you know, it's, again, this is still... when Expanded Universe hasn't yet been decanonized, right? We can assume that there is some shadow of the Palpatine that can generate planet-sized force storms, you know.
Yeah, he is also the inheritor of like 1,000 years of Sith legacy. So like there is like this massive resentment. Like it's like a grudge is also an important thing that you don't like feel a lot of in the film. Like you can infer it, but there is like a direct like, we have been in the shadows too long, like I am directly humiliated, like I am genuinely, this is the revenge of the Sith. Like there is a thing they are getting revenge for. Notably, what they're getting revenge for is very silly, and it's from a very ancient book where someone uses a force bomb it kills everybody.
Wait, is that like a spirit bomb?
It's kind of like that. But I think they call it a force bomb in the original one. But yeah, it kills everybody, and then it creates a thing of ghosts. And then there's one Sith left. I forget his name, but he makes armor for himself out of like this type of bug that crawls all over him. And so many of them crawl, and they link together and make armor. It's kind of fucking sick.
I think this was in the comics. There's one Sith Lord that is just bizarre to me, but like weirdly compelling. You ever heard of Darth Vectivus?
No, I don't think so.
He was a dude who his whole thing is he's just literally a nerd, right? He was a dude who ran this like mining concern or something, and he found this Sith holocron on the planet that he was like mining out, right? And he's like, oh, like this is the source of all the like negative energy that's like really harshing my workers' vibes, right? So he actually moves his whole mining operation off world, and he devotes his life to study of this like lore, and he just becomes a Sith Lord like based on that, right? And I mean,
so stats, he just stacks dark side stats.
Yeah,
like, I guess that's what my build was. Yeah.
Well, and you know, he effectively becomes, you know, space rich DeVos, right? You know, he's a compassionate capitalist, right? He dies surrounded by his friends and loved ones at old age, you know, and he's like the only Sith Lord that never fought.
Very interesting.
It's those kinds of concepts that we are never going to see in a live action film.
No, very, very likely not. Very likely not. So you then have, they land, and then you immediately see, okay, the war outside is simple for Anakin and Obi-Wan. You just fight. The battle on the ground is a lot more complicated because politics, and politics are bad. Or as Yoda says, in motion are the events of our time. Approach a crisis does, because apparently Yoda's been reading Gramsci. I don't know. And also, Palpatine is just running the Duma from like 1906, basically. It's a Senate that is just completely an advisory body at this point, that basically just exists to when the people have complaints. It's like, well, we've got democracy, and they can direct their attention to Palpatine.
And notably, like this is at the end of a long, long series of, you know, I mean, the Republic is 25,000 years old, right? And
yes.
You know, so who knows what sort of transformations have taken place? But I mean, from the beginning,
it's collapsed twice before now. So
it has, yes. And at the beginning, I mean, you know, the beginning of fucking episode one, right? I was thinking about this. The Trade Federation, one of the, you know, corporations that goes on to help start the Civil War and is bankrolling the whole thing, right? The Trade Federation has representation in the fucking Senate, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, imagine Microsoft having a senator, right?
Yeah.
Like it's a level of naked political, political control that. You know, if corporations don't have in this world, it's only because they haven't really bothered to in that particular form.
True, true. So you then have this like moment, which like Stover's very interested in Windu just because he wrote a whole book with him as a major character. But you have this part where Mace Windu is looking at Anakin and Palpatine, and it says, "To Mace's force perception, the world crystallized around them, becoming a gem of reality shot through with flaws and fault lines of possibility. This was Mace's particular gift, to see how people and situations fit together in the Force, to find the sheer planes that can cause them to break in useful ways and to intuit what sort of strike would best make the cut, though he could not consistently determine the significance of the structures he perceived." And it went on for some times. And anyway, he basically sees Anakin as a lever and Obi-Wan and Palpatine on either side pulling. And he's just like, "Huh, I wonder who the Sith Lord is." And he literally says the only reason I don't think Palpatine's a Sith Lord is because he already runs the galaxy. And it's like, yeah, but also like you found like they he had everything set up, and I'm just saying, and Mace Windu starts talking about doing a coup here, which of course makes Anakin doubt the Jedi, honestly, which like fair enough. It leads to a whole bunch of shenanigans. A whole bunch of shenanigans that could be avoided with like a more honest conversation with, your most powerful and famous guy.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting, right? You know, the gloss on this that we see later on is okay, well, like he mentions the so part of the reason that the Jedi don't see anything coming canonically is that, oh, there's a shadow on the Force, right, that's clouding our perceptions, right? And Matt Stover touches on this briefly. I don't think he really engages it. I don't think he really likes that plot point.
Yeah, I'm not really sure how that's supposed to even work, you know?
Right, but it's interesting the picture that he sketches around it, right? Our first meeting in the Jedi Council in the book notably mentions that, well, you know, there was a time when the Jedi Masters on the Council would, you know, they wouldn't speak, right? They would spend their time, their meetings in like quiet contemplation of the Force. They would like navigate and perceive, you know, each other's like vibes and come to a conclusion on whatever the issue of the day is. But now, you know, like the meetings consist of them talking over each other, arguing, you know, there is this disruption of the flow to which that they're accustomed, right? You know, the world is moving in ways that they can't necessarily easily perceive, you know. So as goofy and kind of hand wavy as the shadow on the Force idea is, it is at least given a sort of due diligence here.
And also, we haven't, we also haven't mentioned Padme. So Padme is pretty important.
Yes.
We can jump through big parts of plot because, again, we kind of assume you know the general gist of the story. But Padme in this book, obviously she's a very important senator, but she's also Anakin's secret wife, and she is pregnant, and Anakin is seeing visions of her death. And that is what it ties the fear dragon to, this idea of all things die, the things he loves. Jedi, obviously not supposed to have attachments. It's why the wife is secret in general. I will note, it's not like a particularly well-kept secret. Like, everybody kind of knows, at least that's close to Anakin. Like, Obi-Wan has a moment where he's like, "Anakin's the father, isn't he?" But like, he knows. Palpatine openly knows. If you asked Yoda would probably be like, "Yeah, probably, man." Like, they're not. There's a novel where I forget what it's called, but it's where Anakin becomes a Jedi Knight, no longer a Padawan. I forget what it's called. It gets referenced in this book though, because it's like it's on the planet Jabim is why I remember it specifically, because he references it in this book. He says, "I don't think I've smiled like that since Jabim," because there's like a really horrifying thing that happens, and he basically relives his mother's death with another woman, seeing another woman die in a similar way. But in that book, it reveals like there's actually lots of Jedi with secret wives and families, and as long as they don't make it a problem, it's just not worth dealing with.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? It's the detachment runs two ways, essentially, right? You know, you are encouraged to, you know, because again, mere detachment, I think, is a vulgarization of Jedi philosophy, right? You are aware of yourself and all things as part of a whole, and thus you allow things to pass into and out of your life accordingly. But you also might not necessarily interrogate very sharply where that's happening in other people, because you know that particular attachment that somebody has adjacent to you, you know, that itself is kind of a thing that you have to sort of navigate, right?
Fun fact, Ki-Adi Mundi, the Jedi Knight on the council with the giant head. You
In
play
which there is
as
a second heart.
Yes, you play as him in the level and Star Wars Battlefront where you get the rocket clone. He has a wife as well. So like it, this thing is not completely I mean there are masters with wives, you know, it happens.
It has a
And
wife,
he
you know.
yeah, he excuses it himself for himself because he says my species is endangered. What was I supposed to do? But maybe
Yeah,
they were
you
endangered because they got these big ass heads with hearts in them. That doesn't make any
know.
sense. That's evolutionarily terrible, Ki-Adi Mundi. But nevertheless, that's Anakin's motivation, and he wants, and this is not in the film, he wants a holocron. He wants access to the secret Jedi archives, which Joss referred to already. Only masters get that. So in the movie where he's like just floored that he's not given the rank of master, in the movie it's just like, okay, he feels bad because this is a slight. And yes, he's mad that this is a slight in the book because this is the man who killed Count Dooku, this is the most famous Jedi in the galaxy, but also because he was like, that's what I could have used to save Padme and y'all just like took that shit from me.
Yes. Yeah, there is a more material basis to his sort of turn on the Jedi Order, you know.
Hence, like the Darth Plagueis the Wise speech, which was of course memed, becomes a little more impactful.
Yes, the speech that he was given to by the Senate.
Yes, the Senate. I am the Senate.
Yeah, exactly.
Prequel memes were huge in like 2018. That was like the thing.
Yeah, That's what I appreciate. You know, there is more to Anakin and Obi-Wan's station in the galaxy. There is more to the their individual motivations, right? And not to say, though, that mere arrogance isn't at play here, because like,
oh yeah, plenty of it.
Because from the beginning, you know, you have Anakin immediately, you know, when he learns that Padme is pregnant, right? And he detects that she's keeping something from him, and he is immediately very suspicious. He is immediately aggressive, not as aggressive as you know, of course, later, but like he interprets it as a personal slight almost.
If we want to talk about the relationship, should we do groomer discourse? No, that's just a Padme's age relative to Anakin's. No, they were both adults. They're both adults when they got together.
Because they also
no, there's no need.
Yeah, it's that thing of where you know, one or the other, I think both of them knew that they were like destined to be connected in some way through the Force. Romantically, I think they that dimension of it they discovered later.
Yes,
I don't know.
True.
We don't want to.
Not,
we
not
don't
sure.
Want to.
Yeah, no, I was mostly kidding. But yeah, Anakin, I mean, obviously has these flashes of emotion from the beginning, which is why he's not a master already. And he's immediately suspicious. He's like, I'm not a master. It's because Mace Windu's mad because he was the youngest master before. Later, there's a part where they say Palpatine was kidnapped even though he was being guarded by a Jedi. And he's like, well, I would kick that Jedi's ass. Like he's like that. Like it's not just a false perception of the council.
Oh yeah, I know. Between his will and the will of the Force, there is no contest, Stover says. You know, like it's he doesn't flow with the Force, you know, he uses it to, you know, blast obstacles out of his way. And fucking Palpatine is very mean girls about this, right? He's being helped across the landing pad. And where is it? Okay. It was entirely extraordinary, Palpatine said blandly, oblivious to Mace's narrowing stare. I know next to nothing of swordplay, of course. To my amateur's eye, it seems that Count Dooku may have been a trace overconfident, especially after having disposed of Master Kenobi so neatly.
He is
totally rising Anakin up.
Very catty. And he has a lot of moments like this through the book where he just throws these little barbs. The dialogue, Stover just kind of punches up the dialogue of the movie for the most part. There are places where the dialogue is completely different. More common than that, there is the line from the movie surrounded by like five other lines that are not in the movie. Like the Darth Plagueis scene is like, wait, if it was filmed, it would be like 10 minutes long. Which that's just what a novelization allows you to do. It allows you to flesh out a scene. You can have Sidious say something like, well, why would you kill a Sith? Just because it's an ideological difference. You know, in the Republic, we have laws against discrimination based on religion and things like that, which I found to be kind of funny. There, I did find a guy on Reddit who said that this is an argument for why Palpatine is a liberal and woke, and that the base Jedi conservatives should be allowed to eradicate the unwashed masses of the Sith. And I'm like, I think you're taking this a little far, man. But I guess that's a reading. At Palpatine is woke? Question mark.
No woke people among the Jedi, I take it.
Yeah, the Jedi don't care if you're gay as long as you hide it. But it's not an anti-gay thing. They want you to hide being straight, too. They just want you to hide everything.
So the Jedi Order is like, don't ask, don't tell.
Don't ask, don't tell, but for everybody. That's the thing. They just don't want to hear about it.
And for everything. Yeah, exactly.
For everything, everyone, everywhere. Mm-hmm. But this is a notable thing, is the Jedi are hypocrites to the last of them, right? Because, and that's what makes Anakin endearing. And it makes him endearing in the TV show, really. Clone Wars fleshes this out, because it's like they all have feelings and attachments, like,
yes.
And they're all telling the other ones don't have feelings and attachments. But like, even Yoda like has stuff he wants and doesn't want. Mace Windu really does. Mace Windu's like, I love the Republic. I love democracy. Yes. Mace Windu like uses the dark side in his fighting style.
Yeah.
Which makes him like a much more interesting character than this in the movie, which like in the movie. Yeah. He's kind of notable because he's Samuel L. Jackson and has a purple sword, which mm-hmm. is cool. But I like that Stover has like this like relationship to Windu, that he's just
yes.
attached to this character. I think that's fun.
Yeah, absolutely. No, like it's yeah. Windu has, you know, of course, his fighting style, right? It's Vapod, right? It's the one that where you let yourself enjoy the fight, right? And you play with you let your emotions drive your aggression, right? And you immerse yourself in that path to the dark side, right? Worth noting, I was looking this up, like there's four notable practitioners of Vapod, two of them fell to the dark side.
Oh yeah, well there you go, that explains that.
But also, like, what you say about Windu loving the Republic, like it's he, again, he has that attachment, right? He has that role of the Jedi as guarantors of peace fixed in his mind, and it's, you know, The vehicle for that is the Republic, right? You know, he literally says, yeah, the Republic is civilization, and outside, you know, there is war and suffering, and, you know, which, you know, you read this and you think, yeah, but Coruscant has lower levels that are like no-go, like areas where there is like weird creatures and toxic air. Like there is absolutely an underclass, and there is death and disease and suffering that has no, you know, there is no visible political project addressing these things to the extent that they're even acknowledged.
The Jedi visit a planet with slavery in episode one, and they're just like, all right, see ya. and they come, and then in two, it still has slavery. And it just, slavery is actually, and then slavery is then formally instated intergalactically under the Empire. But it's human slavery is illegalized, because the Empire is actually, they did take that little bit about that, but then they have this whole thing where they're like human debt slaves, and it's a whole thing.
Yeah. And like, to my mind, like it's an interesting contradiction here, right? Because Mace recognizes that the, you know, the Republic is corrupt and that it's lost its way, you know, and all that sort, and all this sort of thing. But again, what is his political project if the Jedi don't intervene in slavery, right? You know, he's willing to, he says straight up when he meets Obi-Wan, we may have to move against the Chancellor. You know, we've given up so much freedom to this dictatorial executive office, and how secure do we look, right?
Here's what they should have done. Mm-hmm. And I said this to you, and I feel very strongly about this. And they could have done all of these things, and it would have worked based on just Mace Windu's vision alone. Step one. Instead of Obi-Wan, you send Anakin after Grievous. Chancellor Palpatine said, I recommend Anakin. Okay, send Anakin after Grievous. That's step one. While he's gone, link up with Bail Organa and do a coup. When you attack Palpatine, film him with the camera or whatever they use to film in Star Wars. They have film.
Palpatine records the whole fucking incident on audio, you know?
Yeah,
it's not like nobody thought about, you know,
Obi-Wan, Mace, and Yoda together kill Palpatine. They overthrow the government, and their first act is, we're going to sue for peace with the Confederacy. That's a broadly popular demand.
Yeah, it is a popular demand, and it's one that Palpatine himself literally shoots down. Like, mm-hmm. he says, oh, well, that would be tantamount to losing the war. And it's like, okay, Palpatine's going to fight to the last Ukrainian, you know?
Yes. By the time Anakin is back. They can prove Palpatine with the Sith Lord. He'll be pissed about it, but there will be no dark side for there will be no Sith Lord for him to turn to. The day is won. I'm just saying that was there. And then, of course, you know, I actually have no idea what happens next. I don't know if the CIS, whatever, fight on. I don't know. I don't know what becomes of all that. It's an alternate timeline. And but this book lends you towards doing that because you see these the Shatterpoint metaphor specifically. You see these shatter points, these little cracks in history, these little moments where it's like, okay, a lot of things are predetermined by all the material conditions, but there are moments of intervention. See, Mace Windu, if he was a communist, would have been an amazing communist, is all I'm saying. He could have been like, no, I can literally see the like Gramscian historical materialist forces, and I'll just tell y'all when to do your revolution. It would have been amazing. But unfortunately, Mace Windu was obsessed with his weird religion and also also like bourgeois democracy for some reason. Not to be the annoying guy about Star Wars, but look, if you're listening to this podcast called The Socialist Shelf about Star Wars, you're here to hear us be annoying about Star Wars. I don't know.
Yeah,
what to tell
exactly.
You.
Exactly. You know,
it's a bourgeois democracy that goes into a fascist empire. That's what it is.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and you know, we're all here to be more informedly annoying about these things.
So
you
true.
Know? That's the thing. And yeah, so there's that discussion between Mace and Obi-Wan. Of course, I was reading about Mace Windu. Like, there's stuff from Harun Kal, and it's like tribal structure, it's culture. That's like, okay, you have four things that you value. Like, you have duty, you know, honor. Like, you have duty to your tribe, you have filial piety to your family, right? But above all that is like the health of the herds, right? You know, the environment that you that your, you know, tribe exists and hunts off of, right? So in that sense, right, you have that sort of context for why Mace would be willing to do anything to preserve this existing status quo that is keeping it running, however imperfectly, right? But yeah, you know, it's neither here nor there, but it's an interesting thing that you know, that Matt Stover has to it's an interesting context that Matt Stover has to write from.
From here, the book's plot moves very quickly. While there's a lot of it, it's mostly like Anakin going through his inner turmoil, which it's actually quite well written. It's not a short book, but it moves very quickly. It's written it's like a very perfect, I think, novelization of a film, right? It is all that it sets out to be, I think, right? Because it's a novelization of a film. It's never going to be some high art. I don't think. I guess there could be an example. It's never going to be something that is like, you know, truly shattering, truly whatever. It's going to be tied to the work itself. But within its context, it is a thing that is immensely readable. It provides new context and information to the film itself, and it has its own unique, incredibly fun style that plays perfectly in the world, which is why I think it's like, you know, if I was ever to write a novelization of a film, this is basically what I would like use as a textbook. But the whole center plot moves incredibly quickly. There's some bits about how like the Senate is being concerned about Palpatine's overreach. So there's Bail Organa, who will adopt Leia and be sort of the founder of the Rebel Alliance. And you have Padme, who's like tied up in this. And Padme is, of course, being kind of treacherous towards Anakin here, which is like one of the little seeds of doubt Palpatine's intentionally sowing. You have the Jedi continuing to be oblivious morons. And you have Obi-Wan going into the Jedi trap, which is this whole fun description of like, how do you make the perfect Jedi trap? Well, first you set this and you set that. And you have it's a blast, Obi-Wan fighting Grievous and like using the Force and like riding a lizard, and it's just this fun ass scene, dude.
This by the way, like, I'm reminded now, it's actually during their fight with Grievous on the Invisible Hand, but there's a moment where Stover describes Obi-Wan using the Force to fuck with Grievous's droid parts.
Oh, like, yeah, that part's cool.
Yeah, reversing the polarity in his hand to make him drop the lightsaber that he's stolen, right? That is there are parts, you know, for all the problems that we have with the conduct of the Jedi and whatnot and where things could have been done differently, there are moments of hashtag discourse in the Star Wars universe that Stover, I think, pretty neatly sidesteps before they become issues.
Uh-huh.
The Grievous one, of course, chief among them, right? Because it neatly answers the question that that my college roommate posed once, which is, oh, why don't, you know, Force users just give each other aneurysms? Well, Tyler, because flesh has a will of its own that can't be manipulated by the Force, you know, that which doesn't apply to droid parts, right? And, you know, the other part of it, of course, is Obi-Wan briefly musing that, oh, you know, General Grievous's starfighter has, like, integrated hyperdrive capability. This hasn't disseminated down, like, widely to crafts of this size. Why don't we have this yet? Which, again, you know, if you've watched Last Jedi and you're wondering, oh, you know, why don't you just mount a hyperdrive on something and send it through what you want dead? That's why. The technology hasn't gotten there yet.
Yes. Yeah, Stover has those like fun little moments because he also was a setup for later. It's a thing he adds to the duel between Anakin and Obi-Wan. Obi-Wan barely surviving due to a clever trick where he uses Anakin's robot hand and reverses the polarity on it briefly, causing him to drop the lightsaber.
Exactly.
Which is a good example of how Obi-Wan and Anakin fight because Anakin's overwhelmingly stronger and Obi-Wan's smarter and cleverer.
Yes, and the impact that they have on each other, right? It comes down to the there's commonalities in their pro. Again, I say that, you know, the pros is calibrated differently according to the perspectives, but there's commonalities between them, right? Chief among them, you know, my favorite, right? When Anakin describes the situation as, you know, not impossible, merely difficult, right? When he's on the invisible hand, and that particular formulation comes back when Obi-Wan's fighting Grievous, right? And he describes, yeah, that's exactly how he talks about deflecting 12 lightsaber strikes per second. Is, you know, it's not impossible, it's just difficult.
Yes. You then have, you know, the Jedi trap is of course just to lure Obi-Wan off world, and there is the confrontation between Mace Windu and his dudes and Palpatine. Mace Windu, of course, making a terrible mistake with Anakin, not making sure dude's emotionally stable before running off. Anakin rolls up on Windu, fighting Palpatine, takes Palpatine's side because he says, you can't kill him. I have to have him to save Padme. And Anakin becomes Darth Vader. And you have like a fun thing at the beginning of him becoming Darth Vader where Palpatine's like, I'll give you whatever you want. Like, what do you want? You want a robe? You want a speeder? You want a planet? You want to save Padme? And he goes, how? And he says, oh, the how's a whole different thing. He goes, we're just talking about what you want. You know, have whatever you want. And he's like, I'm the guy who'll give you whatever you want. I'll give you my life. You know, he's a master deceiver. And of course, the dark side is this just raw expression of emotion. You know, when we insult the Jedi for their like kind of narrow way of thinking, the alternative, though, is the exact opposite. It is pure impulse. It is pure whatever. It's just acting on selfishness, essentially, which we'll reveal later on, and I'll read the quote a little later, that you are then, of course, ultimately just left with yourself.
Yes.
When you
act. Yes.
It is not more powerful. That's a misconception. It is a lot easier, though. It's a lot quicker. Kind of cooler. We'll be to editorialize. It's a little cooler, too. Lightning and shit. Anakin then is like, fuck it. I'm going to do what I can to save Padme. And if that includes tearing down the Jedi Order, they did nothing but treat me terribly and throw me aside anyway. And you have the classic execute Order 66. And look, we've played the Battlefront 2 mission where you go into the Jedi Temple and shoot people up. We know what we're talking about here. You got to use the rocket launcher because they're just going to deflect the lasers.
Remember, no Jedi.
No Jedi, exactly.
Yeah, no younglings, you know. Yeah, no, it's interesting to see where people kind of have their horizon, right? Where they finally decide to act.
No younglings. Sorry, go ahead. Oh, that got me.
We love our murder. It's interesting to see where people finally decide to act, you know, because Anakin, I mean, from the beginning, Anakin is impulsive, right? You know, from the beginning, he is. He's our problematic fave, right? You know, because again, I say, you know, when he realizes that Padme hasn't yet told him, you know, that she's pregnant, right? And he's like, what are you hiding? There's something between us, isn't there? There's something between us, and she's literally like, Anakin, you're hurting us, right? When he grabs her arm, right? It's there is already that germ of okay, he's going to do something rash. But, you know, he has that perfunctory resistance, right? Well, you know, this isn't how I've been taught. You know, the Jedi have taught me that, you know, the Jedi are good and the Sith are evil, right? But, and, you know, it's, there's a certain inevitability that that you play with that they had to work through, right? When Padme is being brought in on the, you know, the, I hesitate to even call it a conspiracy in the Senate because there's not really a political project, right? They just kind of deliver a petition.
Yeah, you know, the conspiracy is only hinted at, and it's whatever yes. Bail Organa and Mon Mothma are doing, which it just assumes you'll know what the Rebel Alliance is if you're reading this book,
yes.
Because that's what they're forming.
Yeah, yeah, and like, you know, Padme is, I mean, you know, she has a past with Palpatine, right? You know, Palpatine was...
They were lovers, in... yeah.
No, yes.
You said they have a past, sorry, go ahead.
Palpatine got around, I tell you what.
He does in Legends. He does. He gets around a lot, and it's its own thing. The there's an elite strike force made of his concubines at one point, and
holy shit!
These God, that 30 years was insane. Anyway,
oh
go
my
on.
God, he's truly slinging some Palpatussy here.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, but yeah, you know, Padme. It takes Padme a little bit to get to her deciding to fight too. You know, half hearted as it might be at first. You know, and she says straight up, you know, Bail, you sound like a separatist, right? In response to the idea that oh, you know, the Senate might actually have to get off its ass and do something, right? Which, to my mind, I mean, I talked to you about this the other day, right? You know, the when you leave militancy and when you leave this sort of grab for political power to reactionary forces like the Sith, right? You know. You cast all militancy as reactionary, even when it takes place in defense of democratic rights, you know, like, because we're dealing with a Senate that has surrendered any pretense to exercising independent political power.
And I note again, like, it's interesting because Palpatine's plan is deliberately set up to be, yes, a masterwork plan years in the making, but also shot through full of potential holes that could fail at several points if people properly intervened and didn't. And that's like intentional in the text. Like the failure specifically of Yoda and Mace Windu is repeated as like a trope. Like Palpatine is not destined to win here. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is by the fact that this is a prequel, but like in the world, he is like, he's not such a master genius that like this was an infallible plan.
Yeah, I mean, you know, fascists are not master geniuses. You know, what he has going for him here is what the, you know, what any fascist has going for him when push comes to shove, right? It is this failure of institutions. It is this failure of bourgeois democracy, essentially, to provide answers to people, right? To defend material interests and attachments. You know, it's I mean, right here, right? He says, I'm afraid I don't believe in the will of the Force. I believe it is our will that matters. I believe that everything good in our civilization has come about not by the blind action of some mystical field of energy, but by the focused will of people, lawmakers and warriors, inventors and engineers, struggling with every breath of their bodies to shape galactic culture, to improve the lives of all, which in isolation is a correct analysis, right? He's just appropriating it for you know, his own particular ends, you know, as fascists do.
And then he, you know, officially founds the Empire. He has this whole speech, and, you know, it's a scene from the movie. It's one of the best scenes from the movie because it's a very visually striking moment. Mm-hmm. The prequels, what they do have going for them is there's some very cool set pieces, none cooler than the Galactic Senate, which is this giant, giant chamber of all these pods that float. It's very neat. And he's standing there and there's the music playing and he forms the first Galactic Empire. And, you know, in the book, it gives it a little more detail. And he says there was a Jedi coup and he presents faked proof and all sorts of things like that. And then he has this speech. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, and notably as well, like the Matt Stover presents like the transcript of the recording, right?
Yeah, I like that.
Where, you know, Mace Windu and Kit Fisto and Aegon Kolar and Sisi Tin, four Jedi Masters, go to fight Sidious. Three of them get murked right away. And the recording ends like after you hear two of them die, right?
Yeah.
So it's unless you're, if you're paying like critical attention to what's going on, it should raise questions.
Mm-hmm.
It should raise questions, but it doesn't.
Yeah. And then you have this you have Palpatine speaking, and he's in the Grand Convention Chamber, and he's at this point he's been scarred and looks like he does in Return of the Jedi. And he says, "These have been the most trying of times. We have passed the test. The war is over." The Senate roared. "The Separatists have been utterly defeated, and the Republic will stand united, united and free. The Jedi Rebellion was our final test. It was the last gasp of the forces of darkness. Now we have left that darkness behind us forever, and a new day has begun. It is morning in the Republic." And then the Senate roars, and you have this whole moment. And then he says, "Never again will we be divided. Never again will sector turn against sector, planet turn against planet, sibling turn against sibling. We are one nation, indivisible, to ensure that we will always stand together, that we will always speak with a single voice and act with a single hand. The Republic must change. We must evolve. We must grow. We must become an empire in fact. We have become an empire in fact. Let us become an empire in name as well. We are the first galactic empire." And it would go on. But, I mean, you can't miss some of the language choices.
Oh yeah, one nation indivisible, you know, like, you know, the 10,000 years, you know, he's got his like 10,000 year space Reich, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's fascism comes to the empire wrapped in a flag and carrying a Bible, you know, as he might say, carrying a space Bible, whatever.
Also, right? not for nothing, later on Anakin says, "If you're not against me, you're my enemy," or if you're not with me, you're my enemy, which sounds a whole lot like the George W. Bush, "If you're not with me, you're with the terrorists."
Right, exactly.
Happened just before this.
Like, I also want to note from the recording, Mace Windu directly accuses Palpatine of being a Sith Lord, and he gives like your classic your classic like debate pervert response, right?
I love it.
Like, "Am I? Even if true, that's hardly a crime. My philosophical outlook is a personal matter. In fact, the last time I read the Constitution, anyway, we have very strict laws against this type of persecution. So I ask you again, what is my alleged crime? How do you expect to justify your mutiny before the Senate? Or do you intend to arrest the Senate as well?" Right? And because this is what fascists do, right? They hide in plausible deniability. They hide behind a state apparatus that is willing to use them to defend its allegiance to the propertied.
It is funny because it's like, what is my alleged crime? It says the death of literally billions. Literally billions. Which I actually wrote that down. I forgot to make a point. It says earlier in the book, Grievous personally has ordered the death of billions, which if you look into it, it means tens across this war, tens of billions have died, which is just an insane. I mean, I know there's trillions in the galaxy, but still, that's a wild number.
Yeah,
there is actually a trillion people who live on Coruscant alone, according to the book I had as a kid of Star Wars planet facts.
Oh yeah, see, I had the visual encyclopedia.
Yeah, there are a handful of those. They were neat. One of them was funny. It was a character book that included legends, but get this, it came out in 2003, and so it did not include Revenge of the Sith. So things that happen in Revenge of the Sith have to just be intuited by the book, and it makes some critical mistakes, and it's very funny.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. One of them being that Darth Sidious and Palpatine are different people.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing. Like, that's the critical error that the Jedi make, right? Because they trace, and of course, you know, we don't get a sense of the false trail that Sidious is leaving, but they trace. We are told that they've traced Darth Sidious to the basement of like 500 Republica, where the Chancellor lives, right? So they're like, oh, okay, so we have found the Sith Lord. We tracked him to this specific location. He must be somebody in Palpatine's inner circle, right? He must be influencing Palpatine in some way, you know.
Would you be shocked that there's a whole book about that?
Really? I know.
Yeah. Sorry, I cut you off. My bad.
No. It's. But again, you know, it's a mistake that is perhaps not so difficult for people to make as we perhaps suggest, right? You know, it's not something that the Jedi just kind of stumble blindly into.
Yeah, that's
true. I mean, they do stumble blindly into it, but like there's a reason. But you know, you don't, again, as you pointed out, you know, you don't need a shadow on the Force to make that mistake. And again, you know, I don't think Stover's really interested in the shadow on the Force explanation. I certainly am not. You know, there's a point early in the book, during the Invisible Hand escape where what is it? Obi-Wan misses something critical that he attributes to the shadow on the Force, and it's like just like some bad intel that he got.
Yeah, Yeah, it's like, how much of this is just an excuse? It's a real question.
Yeah.
So Anakin is sent to officially end the war by killing the leaders of the Confederacy.
This is the best part of the entire book.
Yeah, speak to that, because I know you got a kick out of this part.
Oh, yes. Yeah, he is Darth Vader by this point, of course. And he goes to Mustafar, where all the leaders of the separatists have holed up, right? By this point, of course, Trade Federation Viceroy Newt Gunray has sent out the signal to deactivate all combat droids. The war is over, and they're waiting for Darth Vader to give them their final reward. Of course, Darth Vader is going to kill them all. And Anakin just fucking memes his way through this whole scene, like he's told, oh my god, you know, like Darth Sidious said it would be left in peace, and he's like, the transmission was garbled, he said you'd be left in pieces.
Or there's one that says, you said we'd be rewarded handsomely, and he says, I am your reward, don't you find me handsome?
Fucking Riz Master Darth Vader.
God, it's so funny. And it is like a notable thing that like Anakin from the beginning is this like theatrical over the top motherfucker. And he continues to be that. And it is one thing that like, if you have any questions about any action Darth Vader ever takes in any of the books or films, it's like, he's still that guy and he's trying to look cool. And like, there's a scene in Rogue One. It's one of the best parts of the movie where Darth Vader goes down that hallway and kills a bunch of people. And people ask, why can't you see Darth Vader? His lights on his chest should be flaring. The answer is, it is not out of character for Anakin Skywalker to literally turn off his own life support to look cool.
Literally. Like, I mean, first of all, yes, I love that scene. You know, I love how he just walks down the hallway. You know, he doesn't waste a step. Like, every single movement of his is slow but deliberate. You know, I love the way he fucking like spins his lightsaber, you know, kind of lazily at first, but then gradually picking up purpose and drive with every step, with every swing. A. But B, you know, I mean, that's just, you're absolutely right. That's just the kind of guy he is. Right here, when he's breaking through into the last like safe room, the conference room door was closed. A barrier so paltry would be an insult to the blade. A black gloved hand made a fist. The door crumpled and fell. Like, he literally punches down a door because it would be cooler.
You think, get this man a fedora, and it could be, you know, he's just like starts. Yeah, Anakin is like one step from like Kimberly Soft from Full Metal Alchemist right now. Like, he's on that type of shit.
This is like Tips Hat, my master.
Yeah, or to Padme or whatever. And at this point, you get Anakin is planning to overthrow Palpatine immediately, because that's what the Sith do. They turn on each other endlessly. They have
Literally,
to.
Yeah,
that's just like the rule. In fact, the whole master apprentice system is made because the theory is every apprentice will be stronger than the master before them, or else the master, because if they are capable of defeating the master. Now, I mean, if apprentices are killing masters in sleep, that there is a question of whether that's actually a sign of greater power. But nevertheless, it did produce Palpatine, so you know, can't argue with results.
Yeah, there is a question of whether that is a sign of greater power, absolutely. And it also occurs to me that that's part and parcel of the fundamental myopia of the Sith, right? Because, okay, you have this incredible power, but, you know, you don't really put it to the test, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mace Windu puts fucking Vapod to the test, right?
That's true.
The pros acknowledge straight up that, yeah, you know, fighting this living shadow on the Force, fighting the Sith Lord Darth Sidious is the ultimate test of an art whose practitioners have to surrender to the dark side, at least temporarily, right? Mm-hmm. And sort of give over their usual detachment to, you know, the thrill of the fight. Obi-Wan, of course, is now on his way to Mustafar by that time. He has, he's gotten to the Jedi Temple where the younglings have been massacred. And there's a beacon that's been set up by Anakin and by the clone forces there, telling all the Jedi to come home. Of course, it's a trap. And he changes it to, he changes the signal to tell them to run and hide, which, again, that's another thing that Matt Stover handles pretty well. It's blink and you'll miss it. But like the big meme that people have is, when they're learning about expanded universe, right? How many Jedi survive Order 66? Like, a whole bunch of these guys seem to have gotten away. And I mean, here's the reason, right? You know, in order for Obi-Wan to have made this choice, you know, he had to have He had to have thought, he had to have believed, he had to have hoped that there are some Jedi who did indeed survive the Order, right? Who did indeed get away from their mutinous forces.
The official number, I think, from Legends was just under 2% survived, which is like a pretty reasonable number. I mean, like that's still like over like 100-something people. Mm-hmm. If you go with the number that there were 10,000 full-fledged Jedi Knights plus about a similar number of Padawans.
Yeah, and like a couple hundred were left, yeah.
Yeah, and there were something like 100 Masters, and then there were this was a piece of lore introduced by the Obi-Wan Kenobi Padawan novels that is actually really interesting, and it's the concept of what happens to people who don't get chosen as a Padawan. And the answer is, if you don't get chosen as a Padawan by age 12, the Jedi find a make work job for you somewhere. So there are tens,
you could just be like
farmers mostly.
Oh,
okay.
Their
main thing.
I'm thinking of just like a like desk job or whatever.
No, it's usually like I say make work, like it is a real job, but it's like a very cozy job where you're guaranteed to succeed. Mm-hmm. Because they're like, these guys are at least somewhat efficient, so proficient. So there are, and Palpatine sees to it that these are killed off as well. But there are tens of thousands across the galaxy of just like make work employees who have like the first 12 years of their life were trained at least rudimentary Jedi skills. So some of these will end up becoming the on the run Jedi Knights because they're like, fuck it, I might as well call myself a Jedi now.
Cool.
Which actually leads to like a fun character who's like deeply insecure and is lying about the fact that he's a Jedi, but is being hunted for being a Jedi. So he has all the negative downsides. And Obi-Wan at one point, it's like one, I forget what it's called, but Obi-Wan at one point is like, wait a second, I didn't see you anywhere. Like, I know there were 10,000 of us, but I don't recognize you. And he was like, okay, listen, I was a farmer, but I was a Jedi till I was 11. Okay. it's pretty funny. Ends up getting murked by Darth Vader because they all do, basically. And then also, if we didn't have surviving Jedi, we wouldn't have comic books where Darth Vader just drops people in increasingly dramatic fashion. And like, what would we do without those?
Yeah, we would be a lot poorer for it.
But who gets dropped in dramatic fashion here? Not the enemy of Darth Vader.
Nope. Padme does.
Yes.
Because she has flown to Mustafar, Obi-Wan stowing away on her ship. And she's like, oh my God, Anakin, they said horrible things about you. They said you killed kids and all that. And like Obi-Wan was telling me this. And I love the reveal here because, Stover says, you know, Anakin wasn't like, oh man, they told you that I fell to the dark side. That's bullshit. Like, oh my God, they told you I killed kids. That's nonsense. The first thing he says is Obi-Wan is alive.
Yeah.
It's a very specific thing that he responds to, right? That you're like, oh yeah, this guy is not only like gone, like far gone, but like he is at the point where he's totally unrepentant about it, right? He has constructed this particular literally his own morality. Like, you know, what is the will of the Force according to his will, right?
Yes. So then you of course have the dramatic duel between Anakin and Obi-Wan after Padme gets choked out. And it is alongside it, you have this duel between Yoda and the Emperor. And as you said before, the duel between Anakin and Obi-Wan's a lot more interesting. It's just this dramatic fight between two guys who do genuinely still love each other. You know, cue that Taylor Swift song. And meanwhile, there is like an interesting aspect to the Yoda Sidious duel. Specifically Yoda's realization of his own failure.
Yes. Yes. I have it highlighted. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to read that?
Then came a turning point in the clash of the light against the dark. Skip a bit. Finally, he saw the truth. This truth. That he, the Avatar of Light, Supreme Master of the Jedi Order, the fiercest, most implacable, most devastatingly powerful foe the Darkness had ever known, just didn't have it. He'd never had it. He had lost before he started. He had lost before he was born. The Sith had changed. The Sith had grown, had adapted, had invested 1,000 years intensive study into every aspect of not only the Force, but Jedi lore itself, in preparation for exactly this day. The Sith had remade themselves. They had become new, while the Jedi, The Jedi had spent that same millennium training to refight the last war. The new Sith could not be destroyed with a lightsaber. They could not be burned away by any torch of the Force. The brighter his light, the darker their shadow. How could one win a war against the dark when war itself had become the dark's own weapon? He knew at that instant that this insight held the hope of the galaxy, but if he fell here, that hope would die with him. Yoda thought. A problem this is.
And it is a problem. And Yoda gets, of course, dropped very unceremoniously by Sidious here. Manages to escape. We all know how it goes. But Obi-Wan does manage to defeat Anakin. But I do find that whole thing interesting because it's like, yeah, that's the fundamental failure of the Jedi, is they are dogmatic and they are trying to do the same thing they'd always done. They're fundamentally conservative. And the idea, and it's interesting, like, because they invite the sort of stagnation, corruption and eventual decay of their society. They're constantly complaining, well, the Senate's corrupt or the Republic's corrupt or whatever. And it's like, yeah, but also like, y'all are not great. Like, I mean, how long has Yoda run the Jedi Order basically by decree? I mean, I know there's the council, but like nobody goes against this. Like, how long has this like green guy run things? Small note, and this is not on Stover, this is on the movies. I really wish in the movies and by whatever in this, both Sidious and Yoda hadn't used lightsabers, like they had just been beyond them. I think that would have been interesting. I think like they're just like, we're both old, so old and beyond them that we don't need them. Not a big deal, just something I've always thought would be cool. But you know, also I know people love their like Yoda flipping around too, so no accounting for taste, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, well, and I also like, and this is anecdotal. Like, I love the Dragon Ball-esque like raising of stakes, right? Where you have this guy who's really powerful, and then you bring in a guy who just like flicks him away with like his finger.
Sure.
Right. So, I mean, up to now, when you're going into the third movie, this is going back to when I saw it, right? When you're going to the third movie, you know what Force lightning looks like, right? You've seen it happen in Star Wars 6, right? You've seen it happen before. And what do you see in the fight between Yoda and Palpatine, right? You see Yoda catching Force lightning.
Which is pretty sick, yeah.
It is. You know, it's an immediate, you know, it is an immediate and effective expression of where he is at as a Jedi, you know, that he can negate that ultimate expression of hate.
Fun fact. The Return of the Jedi novelization, Luke deflects the lightning at the beginning of it. This comes out when Return of the Jedi comes out, and Lucas has less involved in this. And yeah, Luke catches the Force lightning and then it just overwhelms his defenses. Yeah. But I wonder if that's where, like, I do wonder, like, did Lucas read that at one point and be like, oh yeah, I'm putting that in there?
Well, notably,
or did they both come to the same idea?
Notably, that's what Mace Windu has to do during the battle with Palpatine, right? When he finds out that Palpatine is the Sith Lord, right? Because he's blocking, he has to use his lightsaber to block the lightning, which, I mean, incredible feat of strength on its own, but it's no, like, catching it in your bare hand.
Yeah, no, exactly right. So, yeah, and then you have the Anakin-Obi-Wan duel. We know how it ends. It doesn't have the highly memed scene from the movie with the "you underestimate my power. I have the high ground. Don't try it." And he flips. In the book, it's kind of unceremonious. They both not in a way that it's not a dramatic fight, but like Obi-Wan and him both jump, and Obi-Wan is just kind of the superior stylist. Anakin's overconfident. And you mentioned earlier he has a lot of interest in like martial arts. It's really interesting the fact that Obi-Wan's a master of Ceresu.
That's
he's got this like very basic style, and he's always and getting
that's,
driven
that's backwards. A really like impactful like set apart line in the Count Dooku bit, right? Because Dooku's, you know, analyzing their forms and whatnot, and he's like, oh yeah, yeah, you know, they haven't progressed beyond this, and then they switch it up partway through and they're like, oh, Obi-Wan had become a master of Ceresu, right? And suddenly the script is flipped, you know, like it's again, because that's the sort of thing that Dooku is looking for, that matters to a you know, an old head like him.
Which is like also why Obi-Wan's able to beat Grievous, and it's why he's able to beat Anakin. Anakin is stronger. Anakin has more raw force power. Anakin is physically more powerful. At one point, he like punches he grabs Obi-Wan, and Obi-Wan says he feels his arms begin to fracture just Anakin squeezing his wrist. But he's able to just sort of get the gap in Anakin's style, cut him down. and then leaves them to burn to become. And you know, you have, of course, very sad. Anakin becomes Darth Vader. No doubt. It's a pretty, it's depressing. It's, you know, the complete fall of a man. And there is this real, there is a real dark bit in, when Anakin reawakens into the Darth Vader suit. And it says, it talks about like, this is how it feels to be Anakin Skywalker. And it says, and it's talking about like what it's like to be him. And it's like, the light burns you. And it says, you don't have lungs, mechanisms hardwired into your chest breathe for you. They will pump oxygen into your bloodstream forever. It talks about it. The breath cannot be stopped or slowed down. It's you open your scorched pale eyes, optical sensors integrate light and shadow into a hideous simulacrum of the world around you. Or perhaps the simulacrum is perfect and is the world that is hideous. It says the voice speaks out and the vocabulator that serves for your burned away lips and tongue and throat. And then it says, you remember the dragon that you brought Vader forth from your heart to slay. You remember the cold venom in Vader's blood. You remember the furnace of Vader's fury and the black hatred of seizing her throat to silence her lying mouth. And there was one blazing moment at which you finally understand that there was no dragon, there was no Vader, that there was only you, only Anakin Skywalker. That it was all you, is you, only you. You did it. You killed her. You killed her because finally, when you could have saved her, when you could have gone away with her, when you could have been thinking about her, you were thinking about yourself. It is in this blazing moment that you finally understand the trap of the dark side, the final cruelty of the Sith. Because now yourself is all you will ever have. And you rage and scream and reach through the force to crush the shadow who has destroyed you. But you are so far less now than what you were. You are more than half machine. You are like a painter gone blind, a composer gone deaf. You can remember where the power was, but the power you can touch is only a memory. And so with all your world-destroying fury, it is only droids around you that implode and equipment in the table on which you were strapped shatters. And in the end, you cannot touch the shadow. In the end, you do not even want to. In the end, the shadow is all you have left, because the shadow understands you. The shadow forgives you. The shadow shadow gathers you unto itself. And within your furnace heart, you burn in your own flame. This is how it feels to be Anakin Skywalker forever. Dot, dot, dot. And that's how it ends that part.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, you know, you're burning in your own flame there. And literally, like, I mean, if you cast your mind back to where Anakin first sort of had his illusions about the galaxy shatter, right? Oh, you know, even stars can die. Even stars can burn out. You know, you're burning in your own flame. Eventually that flame will burn out, right? The only thing you have to look forward to, the only comfort in this moment is death.
Right. Absolutely. Death and the ability to inflict further pain. And there is actually like a direct follow-up novel to this. I forget who wrote it, but like about him just viciously hunting down surviving Jedi and learning how, and it's interesting, he's learning how to use his mechanical body and all that, but more notably it's just becoming what Darth Vader is, who is just a creature that is endlessly regretful. Like, he is just constantly living in this unspeakable regret. He builds his castle on the spot where he had his limbs cut off and he burned. He builds his castle there. He's reflecting on it. Yeah. That's literally where he literally lives and dwells upon it. When he spends all his time either fighting or just like meditating on evil. He kills because he can. His only fun is in sort of the theatricality of his presentation. He is pure misery. It is interesting because there is a post-2014 comic series that kind of gets into Vader pre his return to the light, very brief return to the light, which basically reveals that Vader for a long time has been the equal of Palpatine and has basically been like any other Sith by now would have challenged their master, especially because Palpatine trains another apprentice. At one point, and Vader fucking finds the apprentice and just kills him. And then he's like, what the hell, man? And then Palpatine does a whole like, well, you can't imagine how badly you've disappointed me on Mustafar. Like, you know, that whole thing. But there is a really good part in it that takes place where it's one of my favorite, actually, like quick comic panels ever. And it contextualizes this scene, which it shows Boba Fett reporting to Darth Vader shortly before the events of episode 5, saying, I found out the last name of the pilot. His last name is Skywalker. And he shows him the picture of Luke. And then it shows him flashback to Palpatine saying, it seems they killed her, you killed her. And he says, what are the children? And says they died as well. And then it flashes back to Vader and he goes like that. Like he makes a fist and he's looking out at he's looking out at space and a single crack appears in the glass just from his anger. And he says, I'll have my revenge. And he just looks and he goes, I'll have revenge for all of it. And it's like really, it goes really hard. And then it also contextualizes him like asking Luke to join him. Like he's dead serious. He's like, join me. We're going to fucking kill the Emperor. But it is interesting because Anakin is supposed to be this guy who surpasses the Emperor. Emperor even says like he'll surpass me. And the Emperor is actually pleased by Darth Vader becoming mutilated like this. He calls him the first perfect jewel box of the Sith because he's someone who can never properly surpass the Emperor, notably without dying, which he, of course, does in episode 6. And I don't know. I think it all ties itself together very nicely thematically. And it is a lot of fun and it is really horrifying. And it really sucks to be Anakin. Gotta say, really sucks to be Anakin. Not fun. But, you know, you killed your wife, so that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing to do.
Yeah. And meanwhile, you know, the rest of the galaxy is, you know, falling under the shadow of the Empire. You know, Bail Organa has to be like, look, I don't know how long I can hold on to my position in the Senate. I'm gonna go along with it. I'm gonna support it publicly, so I don't get you know the hard hand of the Empire falling down on me. You know, no matter what you see, just know that I'm on your side still. You know, Yoda goes off to Dagobah. He agrees to take tutelage from the Force ghost of Qui-Gon Jinn, of course, who has died and who has communed with the Force and learned so much from that. You know, Yoda acknowledges that, you know, he himself is still a student, even though he's coming on 900 years.
Deleted scene from the movie, actually.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Very weird because it all comes back to George Lucas's original idea that Star Wars was going to be called the Journal of the Wills. In total.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's this idea of this like wills shaman and stuff, but it never really quite explains what it all is. Clone Wars gets into it a little bit, but it still never quite explains everything about what the shaman of the wills is. There's a lot of explanations for it and none of them are quite satisfactory to me. But it is like an original idea Lucas had that basically he never fully fleshed out and he just kind of let lie. Mm-hmm. But there is in the light, in detachment, in ultimate compassion, which I find notably, he says not just detachment, but also compassion. So not detachment in uncaringness, but in like, I am not selfish. I care for all things around me.
Yes.
That is how immortality can be gained. The ultimate Sith goal that they can never have because they cannot reach beyond the self.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. You know, and it's the fatal error that, you know, Yoda makes, you know, it's the fatal error that Jedi philosophy makes, you know, Yoda being, you know, at the pinnacle of that, right? When Anakin goes to Yoda early on in the book and asks him, hey, like, I've got this, I'm asking for a friend, right? I've got this person that I'm really scared for. And Yoda's like, you know, all things pass, mourn them not, miss them not. And, you know, Stover says straight up, that was when Anakin knew that Yoda would be no help at all, right?
It's Which
that
fundamental,
yeah, you know, it's that fundamental alienation, right? You know, it's you know, the Jedi Order does not have an answer, right? They don't have, you know, they don't have any room even for processing it beyond the most sort of superficial of acknowledgement of, oh yes, I have had this emotion and now I don't have it anymore.
There is a moment that I think encapsulates that even better, and it's where Anakin says. Talks about like being afraid of people dying and then Yoda says like don't have attachments and Anakin says so why do we save if it doesn't matter if people die then why save anyone at all and then Yoda says we're not talking about anyone we're talking about you specifically but it's a rhetorical trick it's a good question to say if people dying doesn't matter then why Yoda is able to get through it by speaking in riddles, but Anakin actually gets his ass on that one. And unfortunately he seeks his answer in pure selfishness.
Yes.
Which is no answer at all. But the answer is in the very, very last poem thing in here, which is after the Matthew Stover description. It's after the afterword. It's after everything.
Other books by this author include, you know, it's in its own way, it's very much like a post credit scene.
Yeah, and it just says the dark is generous and it is patient and it always wins, but in the heart of its strength lies weakness. One lone candle is enough to hold it back. Love is more than a candle. Love can ignite the stars. And of course it's you know, it's trite and a little cheesy, but it is the answer to the question, the problem of the dead star dragon, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that the stars can be reignited. The idea that, you know, something is meaningful enough to continue to persist, mm-hmm. and that things come out of things that are bad. And of course there is that, let's say, new hope lingering on the horizon of Anakin, or of Anakin's kids, of Luke and Leia, that will, you know, come to fruition in the original films that we all know and love, and the novelizations, which are thoroughly fine.
Yes,
I'll say none of the other novelizations of the films. I actually have not read the novelizations of the Disney, close Disney, but the original six. This is the only one that is of any particular interest to me, though there is some really specific descriptions in the episode one novelization of how force pushes work, because it's not on their body, it's the air they're using.
Yes.
But like the guy who writes that is very interested in it. But aside from that, not a whole lot going on there. But anyway. Oh, so we've gotten through this story. Joss, what are your thoughts? What are we walking away with here?
I mean, again, you know, you have to have Bale stumbles upon this too late, right? You know, he stumbles upon the necessity for, you know, the Senate to act, to have a political project beyond, you know, their own aggrandizement, right? And that's the thing, right? There is no Communist Party of Alderaan, right? There is no real sense of the masses outside of their reaction to the Jedi fighting those dirty Seppers, like the Separatists, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's the people are removed from the war. They are removed from politics. There is no, again, it's the fundamental problem that the second trilogy has, right, is that ultimately at the end of the day, the fate of the galaxy comes down to two bloodlines, you know? What I think this book highlights, and again, you know, Stover himself is like a fairly, I think, boilerplate liberal, but what this book really highlights is institutions in and of themselves are tools. And like any tool, they can rust, you know, and in the hands of, you know, in the hands of a bad carpenter, they can absolutely just break, right? And the question is not, you know, not merely the institution itself, but the class character of the institution, right? It's the people at the wheel, right? It is the purpose for which that institution is wielded. And if you don't have that in mind, if you are, you know, it's the difference between the conservative and the reactionary, right? The conservative seeks to change nothing, right? Which leaves the door open for the reactionary to change everything for the worse, you know? Mm-hmm. And there is no counterforce in this, you know, there is no progressive force in this. Mace Windu stumbles on it. Bail Organa stumbles. Based Organa, Bail Organa stumbles upon it. But you know, they're too late to be a historically progressive force. You know, we know their fate.
Yeah, he died. Bail Organa dies on Alderaan when it blows up. Notably, he was kind of like Fail Organa in that moment. Am I right? Am I right? Dunked on. Yeah, and I guess if we really want to abstract it out further, when the Rebel Alliance wins, what happens? They get a new government for like 20 years, and then it goes down to counter-revolution, basically. And then nobody wins because everybody's just fighting. You know, spoiler alert if you care about the, what is it, Rise of Skywalker, but it basically ends with no government. I don't know if there's going to be more movies that set after that. I don't know that I particularly care, but one can imagine they're like, well, I guess we've just completely, the government has just completely collapsed on both sides. So that's where we're at now. Notably in the Legends Continuum, which of course Stover was working with, the New Republic would actually be a force that would exist until an invasion from outside the galaxy that would then cause it to collapse in a horrifying intergalactic war that then ends with just sort of a shell of the Republic left behind. But that's, the Vong are its own thing. We'll say that's a whole fun separate.
Yeah, that's a like 20 book series
Oh
that
my
we
God.
will not be getting into in its entirety.
No, not at all. But you know, if you like the idea of giant spaceships that are grown, you know, check it out, I suppose. Very hokey. But yeah, no, this book, you know, I enjoyed it as a kid and I enjoyed it again now. It is, I think it accomplishes what it sets out to do. It raises interesting questions. It's actually like quite fun to think about the ramifications of things in universe. It allows you to kind of get inside the head of a force user, which is a no small feat, considering how effortlessly it kind of happens multiple times throughout the book. And it you know, it ignites what I, you know, like about Star Wars, which is that kind of open possibility, but it feeling very homely, feeling very like down to earth is a weird way of putting it, but like feeling like the direct connection. It doesn't feel super far removed. It doesn't feel super high fantasy. It is not going to explain every detail of everything. It's just like this fun kind of one step explained above Flash Gordon world. But you know, it's very lived in, and it opens a lot of directions, and this book definitely brings me back to that time where I was like really, really invested in it, and writing, you know, Clone Wars fan fiction, which there was a officially sanctioned by Star Wars fan fiction website. Like, it was the Star Wars, LucasArts ran the fan, had a fan fiction website. It was moderated by them, and the moderation was really bad, and it like banned a lot of things for no particular reason, but I was allowed to use it as a kid because it was run by LucasArts. So, you know, shout out to LucasArts for having a child safe fan fiction website that allowed me to write my little stories about Ahsoka surviving Order 66, which it turns out she did. So I predicted the plot of Rebels.
Fuck yeah.
So I'd like to see my check, LucasArts. You can make it out in cash, or you can make it out to PSL Atlanta, like I talked about at the opening of the episode. Well, Josh, do you have any final thoughts before we take this one home?
You know, go out into the galaxy, and you get the billions of galactic denizens, human and otherwise, organized, you know, because otherwise there's this dude called Palpatine scheming like Badim, you know, to overthrow the galaxy. You know, you have to be a motive force in opposition to those people over there just fighting over the fate of all things. You know, there is more out there than just great men of history. There's more out there than just great men of the galaxy. You know, it's not heroes that make history. It is history that makes heroes.
So we have made a decision, not just cut out of this podcast. We definitely made it well ahead of time, because we plan these things well ahead of time.
We've had this planned for 1,000 years, just like Palpatine.
Yeah, just like Palpatine. We are going to be talking about Arthur Miller's The Crucible. And if you're lucky, I might just pull some audio clips of me from high school reading some of the monologues from it.
Let's go.
I might be able to find it. It's going to be hella echoey, but I'm pretty sure some of those are still up and like some dusty Facebook archive somewhere. So I'll go on the hunt. But Arthur Miller's The Crucible, our first foray into theater, if I'm right. Though this book was quite theatrical, so that's something. Joss, what do we want to close this one out on? I could just sing the Taylor Swift song. So I will, if you don't come up with something, I will just sing the Taylor Swift song.
I would never dream of taking that away from you, Jacob. Okay.
I didn't have it in myself to go with grace, and so the battleships will sink beneath the waves. You had to kill me, but it killed you just the same. Cursing my name, wishing I stayed. Look at how my tears ricochet. And that is the plot of Revenge of the Sith.
Ooh, have a good one, everyone. Look what you made me do. Look what you made me do. Look what you just made me do.
The old Taylor can't come to the phone right now. Why? The old Anakin can't come to the phone right now. Why? Because he's dead. Have a good one, everyone.
Peace out.
Thank you for listening to Socialist Shelf Radio.